WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Two bomb blasts in London last month signaled the end of the 17-month ceasefire, which had brought peace to Northern Ireland and halted terrorist attacks in England. The IRA claimed responsibility for the bombings, which killed three people and injured many more. The resumption of violence threatens future prospects for peace negotiations, but talks are scheduled to resume in June. My guest, John Hume, was instrumental in forging the ceasefire and setting the peace process in motion. He met secretly with Gerry Adams, the head of the IRA's political wing, Sinn Féin, to establish negotiations between the London and Dublin governments and parties in Northern Ireland. John Hume has been a voice for nonviolence in Northern Ireland, where 25 years of political warfare have left 3,000 dead and more than 30,000 wounded or disabled. He is a founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, which has worked for the unification of Ireland. John Hume has written a book about his efforts to bring about a reconciliation called A New Ireland. I asked him about the recent bombings in London.
Well, of course, it was very, very regrettable, and the London bomb was an awful atrocity. And the 17 months of peace really transformed the atmosphere on our streets, and the mood among the people for peace was very, very powerful. It was very heavily underlined by the visit of President Clinton because it gave the people the opportunity to speak with their feet, to come out in their thousands to welcome him and express their massive support for peace and their massive gratitude to President Clinton for the role he had played. And that mood is still there very powerfully, and that's what gives me hope, that the mood for peace is so strong, because given that for the first time in their life, young people under 30 had experienced what peace really meant, and that has created an enormous mood, and I think no one can ignore that, and I'm hopeful that we can restore the peace process. I think that when the peace process started, I engaged in dialogue with Gerry Adams, the leader of the Sinn Féin, and we stated two objectives in our dialogue. One was a total cessation of violence, followed by all-party talks, whose objective would be agreement among our divided people. And the agreement would have to have the allegiance of all traditions. In other words, a process that threatened no one. Unfortunately, we achieved the first stage, which was a total cessation of violence. But 17 months later, for different reasons, we hadn't moved on to the next stage, which was all-party talks. And I think that the delay in moving to all-party talks was one of the reasons that we are in the situation we're in today. But I certainly hope that we will restore the peace on our streets.
Have you spoken with Gerry Adams since the bomb blast in London?
Oh, yes, I have spoken. I maintain regular contact with him, and we're both working very hard to restore the peace process. In fact, we both met with the IRA to persuade them to restore the peace process, and I hope that we will be successful.
In meeting with the IRA, what was their explanation for the bomb blast?
Well, they explained in their statements that, in their view, they thought that the peace process wasn't moving forward. My meeting with them was to persuade them to stop again. And they said in a statement afterwards, of course, that they are willing to embrace a negotiated settlement. In other words, I believe that if we can get a firm commitment to all-party talks whose objective is a comprehensive negotiated agreement among our divided people, I believe that we can restore the peace process. And I think that I welcome very much the fact that both governments have now committed themselves to a very firm date for all-party talks, and I hope that we can achieve the situation where all parties will be at those talks without preconditions.
Who and what do you hold responsible for the delays in the negotiations? As you said, that the ceasefire had been in effect for 17 months, but negotiations hadn't really gone forward. Why not?
Well, I think that one of the reasons was that once the peace broke out, once we had a total cessation of violence, then the British government produced a precondition that there should be decommissioning of arms before talks took place. In other words, that there should be a handing over of arms by the IRA, which in Irish terms amounts to a surrender. And of course, anyone who knows the Irish knows that there's a very powerful no-surrender mentality. And that's not something that has ever happened anywhere else where there's been conflict. And that delayed matters quite substantially. And then, of course, Senator George Mitchell's commission was appointed to resolve the situation and, in my opinion, produced a very sensible report. But unfortunately, that report was not, although it was praised very warmly by everyone and by the British government in particular, it wasn't implemented. And instead of that, they announced the possibility of further elections, etc. And I think it was at that stage that the IRA, unfortunately and tragically, decided to resume their campaign. In my belief, had the Mitchell report been implemented, we would still have peace in our streets.
Do you think it is possible to negotiate when various factions are armed?
If we're going to have lasting stability and lasting peace, we have to have agreement on our system of government. And the only way of achieving that is by bringing all parties to the table. All parties to the table. That should be the urgent priority of everyone, particularly of governments. And tragically in Ireland, the gun has been part of our history on both sides of our divide. And as I keep saying over there, quoting Martin Luther King, the old doctrine of an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. We've got to get the gun out of our politics. And my view is that given the 20,000 soldiers haven't stopped it, and 12,000 armed policemen haven't stopped it, and the strictest security laws in Europe haven't stopped it, that if I could stop it by dialogue, it was my duty to do so by dialogue. And I believe that dialogue brought us 18 months of peace, and it's dialogue that will bring us lasting peace and stability. And it's for that reason I want all parties, including those that represent the armed groups, at the table.
Because this conflict has been so personal, because everybody has been touched in one way or another by the violence, does that make it easier or harder to try to find a negotiated settlement? On the one hand, I would think that for some, the need for revenge is very powerful.
My greatest encouragement came in the many letters I received from people who had lost their loved ones. And they were mostly saying the same thing to me. Keep talking, because if by talking you can save human life, you will be preventing people from suffering from what we have had to suffer. And they wrote to me telling me that they were wishing me well and praying for me. And one of the most moving occasions I had, when I attended a funeral of six people killed, murdered in a bar by loyalist paramilitaries in my district. And as I was at the funeral, a young girl came up to me and said to me, "We were praying for you around my daddy's coffin last night. We were praying that you would be successful in your talks to get peace, because we don't want what happened to us to happen to anyone else." That was real Christianity. And when you consider the situation in Northern Ireland, where you have the highest church-going population in Western Europe in the city of Belfast, it's been necessary to build 13 walls to separate and protect one section of that people from another. Then the powerful message of that young girl is a real message of peace. Revenge is not a solution. Revenge only carries on the problem. And those walls are a challenge to all of us, because what they scream at us is that our past attitudes have built them. And therefore, if we are to resolve the problem, each side has to re-examine its past attitude.
John Hume is my guest, and he's the founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, a member of the British House of Commons, and the author of a new book called A New Ireland. What is your vision and the vision of the other nationalists within Northern Ireland for its future?
Well, of course, we recognise that we are a divided people, and therefore that any solution must respect the diversity of our people. And for that reason, we have to create institutions in Ireland, within the North and between North and South, which respect our differences. And in doing that, I think we will be considerably assisted by the fact that we are now living in the new Europe, where 50 years ago, the peoples of Europe, 135 million people lay dead, 50 years ago, right across Europe. Who could have forecast then that in 50 years' time there would be a united Europe? and the Germans are still German and the French are still French, yet it has happened. And how did they do it? They did it by recognizing that difference is not a threat, that difference is natural. There's not two human beings in the entire human race who are the same. It's an accident of birth, what you're born and where you're born. And that accident of birth, whether of color, nationality or religion, should never be the source of hatred or conflict. The answer to difference is to respect it, not to fight about it. And to build institutions, which is what they did in Europe, institutions which respected their differences but allowed them to work together in the common interest, which is economics, bread on your table and a roof over your head.
You favor the unification of Northern Ireland with the Irish Republic.
Well, like many Irish people, I would like to see the unity of Ireland. But recognizing that the real border in Ireland is not a line on a map, it's in the minds and hearts of people. I recognize that you can't remove a border in the minds and hearts of people in a week or a fortnight. What we need to do is create the institutions that allow our people to work together. And as I was just saying, if we follow the European example and set up institutions within Northern Ireland that respect the differences and involve both sections of our community, and institutions between North and South, which allow us to work together in our common interest, that by working then together through those institutions in our common interest, spilling our sweat and not our blood, our common interest being economics and building the country, and of course in that we would get massive assistance from the Irish in America. And that will then evolve into a new Ireland in a generation or two, whose model of which will probably be very different from the traditional models of the past, but it will be built by agreement and by respect for diversity.
Let me get you to be specific, if I can. What would be an example of an institution you think that would gather people together of common interests and create, or I guess as you see it, would erase the kind of mental border between North and South?
Well, take my own city, the city of Derry, where the Troubles started, and which was the worst example of injustice in the old Northern Ireland, because the Unionists were 30% of the population, yet they governed the city by a system of gerrymander and discrimination in housing and jobs and voting rights. Now, my party, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, are in charge of the city. We have a major majority. But what we do instead of what we do in running the city is we change the mayor each year. We could have the mayor every year, but what we do, we take it 1 year, Unionist the next year, Catholic, Protestant. We change the mayor every year. The chairs of the committees in the city council, we give one to each party. We could take all this, but we don't. And what that does is creates a team spirit. We respect our differences at the political level and we work together for the city. And of course, in the last 12 months, we've had 2,500 jobs from American investment into our city, which is, our city is now the European headquarters of DuPont, of Fruit of the Loom, of Seagate International, and Stream International recently announced that they're coming in. So we've, by working together, as I say, spilling our sweat and not our blood. In other words, by creating institutions which respect our differences and give a role to each section of our community, that's really what we're talking about.
I'm speaking with John Hume, the founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland. He's a member of the British House of Commons and the author of a new book called A New Ireland. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. John Hume is my guest, and he's the founder, leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, and his new book is called A New Ireland. You were born in 1937. You grew up in Derry, the oldest of seven children. What kind of a neighbourhood did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in what would have been a mixed neighbourhood in Derry terms, both sections of the community. But it was very working class, a lot of unemployed people. My father was unemployed. That was, in those days, the unemployment was very, very massive. And, of course, in the Catholic community, a lot of it was a result of serious discrimination against us.
Well, your father lost his job when you were 8 years old. This was after World War II. He never worked again.
That's correct. He was a very, very, in my opinion, a very brilliant man. He hadn't been educated, because in his day, if you came from working class or poor backgrounds, you didn't get educated if your family didn't have the money to pay for you. I was lucky in that I was 10 years old in the first year of a new system of examinations in Northern Ireland, of public education, which if you passed the examinations, you got scholarships. It paid for your education at secondary level. And I was very lucky to have passed that and got my scholarship, and got scholarships right through to university without it costing my parents anything. And of course, I believe that that transformation in education, while nothing had happened to deal with the discrimination against our population politically over the years, I think the biggest thing that happened to change the situation was public education, because it produced a whole new generation of educated people from the minority community in Northern Ireland. And they applied their minds to creating justice and equality for all sections of the people.
Your father then, after you turned 8, he never had a job again. Would he go down every day to look for work, and he was denied work?
Oh, yes. I mean, but, you know, in addition to the fact that work didn't exist, it was part of the policy of the unionists running the city at that time not to bring work into the city, because they were 30% of the population, and in order to control the city, they were encouraging emigration because they didn't want more jobs and more work made it more difficult for their gerrymandered electoral system to work.
Was your father bitter?
No, he was never a bitter man.
Why not?
I don't know why not, but he never was bitter, and he did a lot of work for other people, because he was a very bright and highly intelligent man. And when I was a child, my earliest memories are sitting at a table doing my homework, and at the other side of the table, my father talking to people who come in for him to write letters for them because of their problems of unemployment and housing and health, etc.
And he could write?
And he wrote for them, yes.
And your mother, as I understand it, could only write her name.
That's right. In those days, you see, the women of Derry built the city, because the only real work in the city were the shirt factories. The first shirt factory in the world opened in Derry in 1842. And it's still a major centre of the shirt industry in the world. And the women of Derry worked in that. And we had a situation when I was growing up when the women did the work, a lot of the work, and the men were unemployed. And my mother, I remember, she, while rearing our family, couldn't go out to work during the day, but she worked at night at home doing outwork for the shirt factories. And, of course, that was very common in those days. And young women, rather than go to school in their early days, went and learned how to make shirts so that they could get themselves work in the shirt factories.
When would you say you became politically active?
Well, it depends what you call politics. Yeah. When I came back from university, I was 23 years old, and I felt that since I was one of the lucky ones, having passed exams, the problems of poverty and unemployment were still very strong in the community and in my own streets. I felt I had a duty to do everything I could. So I got involved in community development, which wasn't party politics. I got involved in the foundation of the credit union movement. I got involved in the foundation of the housing association, whereby we set up our own self-help housing body to build houses for our people, because the politicians wouldn't give them housing. And how I got into politics was when they wouldn't give us planning permission to build houses, because it would have upset the voting balance in the gerrymandered districts. Then I went to the streets in the civil rights movement. And of course, that was in the 60s. And the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland was very heavily inspired by people like Martin Luther King. And I was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement, and that led me directly into politics.
You write in your book that the strife between Irish and English races can be traced back to the 12th century, and you say that Northern Ireland today represents unfinished business in ancient conflicts between two islands. That seems like an enormous undertaking to try to put 800 years of history at rest, 800 years of violence and certainly suspicion, repression, and suffering. What makes you optimistic?
Well, of course, what makes me optimistic is that the world we're living in today is a very different world than the world of the past. We're living in a new Europe. For Britain came into Ireland in the first place because of Ireland's links with Spain and France. She wanted to close the back door to her what were then her European enemies. And, of course, the Northern Ireland problem is not a Northern Ireland problem. It's a British-Irish problem. The failure of Britain and Ireland to sort out their quarrel of sovereignty was pushed into a corner and called Northern Ireland and sat there for 50 years until it erupted. But now Britain and Ireland are together in a new Europe, together with the Germans, the French, the Spanish. We're now living in a post-nationalist world. We're moving beyond the nation state. And of course, that should make it easier for us to Britain and Ireland work together in common at European level, together with the French and the Spanish, so that, as I say, that new world and new atmosphere should make it easier for us to settle that ancient quarrel.
John Hume, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Hume is president of the Social Democratic and Labour Party in Northern Ireland. His book is entitled A New Ireland. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.